You're listening to The 21st. I'm Christine Herman. The United States spends more than $3 trillion on healthcare every year. But all that spending doesn't mean we have the best health outcomes. Often it's the reverse. And lots of people are feeling the squeeze of rising healthcare costs. Today, one in five Americans has medical debt in collections. A new book explores how the skyrocketing costs of healthcare are bankrupting people and highlights what you can do to protect yourself. It's called The Price We Pay, and I'm joined now on the line by the author, Dr. Marty McCary. He's a surgeon and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. McCary, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Christine.
Just to start off, there's so much conversation about healthcare these days, especially in the political arena. So why did you want to write this book? Why now? What did you feel like was missing from the conversation about our healthcare system that's already out there?
Well, I began to see how our patients are getting hammered. You know, these patients did not come to the billing department for care. They came to us as physicians, and we have an incredible history of a great public trust with the community. And that great public trust is now being threatened by the money games and even predatory billing practices. Look, I've got partners in my hospital who say, Marty, why are you working on this stuff? And I tell them, look, we can have the cure for cancer, but if half of the public does not trust us and won't come in for care, those cures are no good. And right now, the public trust has been eroded by these many money games, and we need to stand up for our patients, call them out, and allow our country to spend money on national priorities instead of letting this broken system suck the money out of every business and household in America.
Yeah, Marty, I want to get into more about the money games in just a second. But first, can you help us understand the U.S. spends more on healthcare than any other nation, and yet we have some of the worst health outcomes? Can you explain why is there that disconnect?
Well, the story that nobody's talking about, that we need to talk about, is that we have a system loaded with pricing failures, inappropriate care, and middlemen that takes a tremendous amount of money out of the system. So it's estimated that a third of all of our healthcare spending is going to things that have nothing to do with health. So we're spending a lot of money into this broken system. If we look at just federal spending, we spend 48% of all federal spending in the United States on healthcare in its many hidden forms. So we need to talk about fiscal responsibility as much as we need to talk about great healthcare in the United States.
So speaking of fiscal responsibility, I want to ask about price gouging. So this is the idea you write about in your book, that a hospital can charge pretty much whatever they want, and you, the healthcare consumer, you have to pay for it. I mean, it would be like if you went to a restaurant where you don't know how much the meal costs until after you've eaten it. I mean, is it at least true that if I go to a place where things cost more, it's better quality?
No, it's not true. And basically, we need to create healthcare literacy. And so if you look at the pricing failures in the market, they are basically gouging whatever the market will allow among some of the stakeholders. Not all. Some hospitals price fairly and bill fairly. But the predatory billing going on is a disgrace. Billing quality is medical quality. Financial toxicity is a medical complication. And so if airlines did not give you a price on a travel website, if you can imagine just airlines telling you, we'll bill you after the flight, there would be price gouging, and we would conclude that a lot of the corporations getting very rich off of a market without showing prices is an example where a lack of showing prices enables price gouging. So there's, you know, as you suggested, if you go to a restaurant and ask to see the menu, they don't say who's your employer, and then you get a secret list of prices, and it's, you know, twice as much as the next table, and each table is contractually gagged not to share the prices. We need open and efficient marketplaces, and right now the exciting thing in healthcare is they are coming. They're here. They are mdsave.com. They are a whole host of navigation tools for patients and a bunch of platforms for businesses who are proxy shoppers of healthcare. And it's cleaning up healthcare, it's creating efficient markets, it's restoring medicine to its mission of not just honest care, but honest billing.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary. His new book is called The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Marty, we've been talking about how many people are feeling the squeeze of these rising healthcare costs. And now hospitals will often say that they don't have very large profit margins, and so they have to charge so much to make up for the costs of providing care to people who are either uninsured or to make up for the difference between like what a service costs and what government insurance programs like Medicare and Medicaid pay. Do you think that's a fair argument, like from the hospital's perspective?
Well, the data would show a different story. American hospitals are on track for their largest profit margin in history. They're making a ton of money. They're building Zen gardens and new granite lobbies, and executive pay and administrators are increasing. Look, we need good people in healthcare, but this nonprofit designation that a lot of hospitals have forces them to spend their money. They will buy new land, build new buildings, pay off debt, do whatever it takes to spend the profit. And then this argument that they're getting by on razor-thin margins just is not supported by the data. Now, small hospitals and rural hospitals are closing left and right as large hospitals are making record profits. You know, a cardiac surgeon at the University of Iowa called 100 centers that do heart surgery and said, "How much does a standard open-heart CABG operation cost?" He fought and called the finance office and haggled. And finally, after all of the haggling, half of those centers, 50, could give him a price. The price ranged from $44,000 to $500,000. He took those prices and compared them to the outcomes of those different centers in the most mature quality outcomes registry we have in healthcare, which is for heart surgery. And guess what? There was no correlation whatsoever. Our team looked at charity care and found no correlation with charity care for the vast majority of hospitals.
Yeah, because some of the most profitable hospitals are nonprofit hospitals, right?
That's right. They don't call it profit. They have different ways, but the amount of cost shift accounting going on would raise eyebrows, I think, among anyone thinking about donating to some of these large hospitals.
So we reached out on Facebook to our listeners to ask if they've had experiences with surprise medical bills or with rising drug costs. We heard from Andrea in Urbana. She says she received a bill from a hospital for $250, but the procedure was actually verified at $30. And I suppose if she didn't know to ask, she might have thought she just had to foot that bill. I mean, is this very common from your experience, from your research?
It is. I mean, the price to deliver a baby, not the sticker price, but the actual insurance payout amount, what we call the negotiated rate, that price to deliver a baby, an uncomplicated baby delivery, ranges from $4,000 to $70,000 in the same city. Take Boston, for example. The price to deliver a baby ranges from $7,000 to $41,000 within the Harvard system. Now, there's no quality explanation for these differences. My hospital, Johns Hopkins, offers below market prices for the vast majority of services. How is that possible? I think we've got good quality, ranked number one in the United States for 22 consecutive years. What is happening is a game where hospitals are profiting almost proportional to the income of the counties that they serve. And it shouldn't really be that way. We should be supporting our small and rural hospitals just the same.
Yeah, I mean, you refer to it as a game. I mean, why is it so complicated? Why can't hospitals just be transparent about things like what something's going to cost?
Well, first of all, good stuff is happening, and they're starting to. When enough people asked for nutrition labels on food, the market responded, and the government followed that market response. And the food industry told us they could not give us labels. It was impossible. And look where we are today. That's the power of individual people and listeners here now asking for prices for predictable services. We doctors are never going to give you a price if you're having a heart attack, and we shouldn't. We need to take care of you. But most of healthcare is shoppable. So there's good stuff happening, and we're seeing hospitals respond. The reason they haven't done it so far is, quite honestly, they're good people leading hospitals. They've just never had to do it before. We've got good people working in a bad system. We are working in a system that we inherited, and that system creates massively inflated prices that go up each year for the purpose of offering secret discounts to different insurance companies. That's a money game. That game is being now changed, and it's these many disruptors who are now challenging the status quo. So I think we've got good people at hospitals. They're just working in a bad system that we've inherited.
And I hope we can talk about those disruptors in a bit. But first, I want to ask about appropriateness of care. You've mentioned this idea of over-treatment or under-treatment. So there were a few times I was reading your book, and I almost closed it and threw it at the wall because it was maddening. And one of those times was when you talked about the overuse of medical procedures, and we hear a lot about rising C-section rates. So it reminded me of my first labor, which ended in a non-emergency C-section. It was Thanksgiving Day. I felt totally pressured into it. The doctor was saying things like, "We all want the baby to be safe," even though there weren't any urgent signs that he wasn't. But I couldn't say no to that. And you write about trigger words. So can you talk a little bit about what are trigger words? I guess these phrases that doctors use to pressure patients into procedures that they may not need?
Well, most doctors do the right thing or always try to. But what we all observe as physicians is that some fraction of doctors nudge patients with these trigger words. And we know what these words are. We're very good at workarounds. We can document what we need to document to justify it in the chart. And these are things like, a C-section, quote-unquote, might be safer for the baby. Now, if you tell that to any woman in labor anywhere in the world, they are going to tell you to do a C-section. It's a nudge, and it's not always fair, and people need to be aware of it. We don't want to create hysteria. You know, in ortho, there's a nudge term that says, hey, your knee hurts, you've got bone on bone. Okay, when you say that to anybody with knee pain, they're going to tell you, well, doc, then go ahead with the knee replacement. Even in my field of cancer surgery, we see some doctors suggest that laparoscopy can insert air in the abdomen, which can spread cancer cells. That's not true. And yet that's one of the many sort of theories that's floated when a patient is asking about laparoscopy and the doctor may not want to do it. Now, not everybody is a candidate for laparoscopy with cancer, but these nudge terms are dangerous. And we can identify, instead of hammering doctors with pre-authorizations, we can instead look at patterns in the data and shunt the resources we use to harass the good doctors to help the outlier doctors. And that's what we can do with this new generation of appropriateness measures that looks at practice patterns and allows improvement among the outliers. You know, we just sent a letter to doctors letting them know where they stand on the bell curve.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that approach that you took? Because it was a relatively small grant, but it led to some major cost savings for Medicare. Is that right?
Yeah, we're doing it in a lot of specialties, but the first project you're referring to was in skin cancer surgery. And the model that I came up with as a physician is to say, let's get doctors in that specialty to agree on a practice pattern measurement of overuse, whatever they think is overdone in their field, and it can be measured soundly. And the skin cancer surgeons told us about a practice pattern of overuse with Mohs surgery. We measured it. We gave them the reports. And of the 2,000 Mohs surgeons in the country, half got a letter saying, this is where you stand on the bell curve on this metric of overuse.
Yeah, so when you're talking about the bell curve, you're talking about like there's an average for a certain specialty for this particular procedure, and the people who are the outliers, it might suggest that they're overusing a treatment or perhaps using it when it's not evidence-based or medically advised.
Exactly. Yeah. They told us that the experts in the field said you should not be removing a skin cancer with more than, on average, about two blocks per cancer, two blocks of tissue. Normally, you take out a block of tissue, check it for cancer at the edges, and then take a second one or maybe third or fourth on rare occasion. They said if you're averaging more than two, you're probably gaming the system because you get paid per block, or you're just not up to date on best practices and you need help. So by showing doctors on average how many blocks they were removing per skin cancer removal, they were able to drive improvement by essentially nudging the outliers to say, hey, you're greater than two standard deviations above the mean among most surgeons in the country. So of the half of most surgeons that saw their data, of the outliers, 83% instantly reduced their pattern of overuse. The improvement was sustained now for 2 years. And the $150,000 grant project to send out these letters has resulted in a $27 million savings to Medicare, speaking to the power of using civility, appealing to the best in people, letting doctors define how they get measured instead of some external force, yeah, and shunting resources to outliers to help them rather than view them as bad doctors.
And with that little nudge, they did alter their practice, at least some of them, as you found in your data. If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Dr. Marty McCary. He's a surgeon and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the author of a new book, The Price We Pay: What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. We have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with Dr. McCary about what's wrong with the American healthcare system and how that's hurting patients. We'll also look towards solutions. Who's doing it differently? And what will it take to restore medicine to its original mission of caring for people when they're at their most vulnerable? As a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you want us to ask on air. I'm Christine Herman. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Christine Herman. We're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary about his new book. It's called The Price We Pay, and it takes a critical look at the American healthcare system and why things cost so much. Marty, so we've been talking about the cost of healthcare, and I wanted to talk to you more about the cost of prescription drugs specifically, because this is almost like a separate issue, but obviously related. We may have seen it in the headlines, the cost of insulin just skyrocketing, and it's led people to do things like to ration it in ways that could be dangerous to their health or be deadly. I mean, we actually received a Facebook comment from a listener about this, so I want to read that. Emily, who says she used to live in Urbana, writes, "I've struggled with insulin costs for most of my adult life. There have been times that even with insurance, my copay has been a few hundred dollars." She says she recently moved to Colorado, which is the first state to put a cap on out-of-pocket insulin costs. She says that now she doesn't have to pay more than $25 a month, but without the cap and with her insurance, a one-month supply would be roughly $750 for 1 month. So I'm sure there are many other stories like Emily's, and your book offers a fairly simple explanation about why drugs are so expensive or why sometimes we can see the price fluctuate or skyrocket. The analogy you offer in the book, I believe, involves Girl Scout cookies. Is that right?
Right. So there is behind the pharmacy counter when you pick up a medication, a middleman, and that middleman is called a PBM or a pharmacy benefit manager. Most countries don't have PBMs. They don't have a PBM industry. The U.S. never had a PBM industry until a few decades ago. And because of a loophole in an anti-kickback statute, these middlemen accept kickbacks from pharma companies. It's a pay-to-play fee to list their drugs on their sort of catalog that's available to employers and pharmacies. Well, they don't call it a kickback, of course. They call it a rebate. And they share sometimes a portion of that with the patient. And so it looks like a shiny object, and people think, oh, what a generous middleman. They're giving me a rebate. The reality is that it would be like a mom saying, hey, I'm going to sell Girl Scout cookies to your business. I will manage the process for you. And you, the CEO, can just pay me directly. I'll charge you and I'll set the co-pays for individuals. And they bring in a bunch of girls to sell cookies and they charge high co-pays. And this mom doesn't really pay the girls fairly for selling the cookies and then gouges the employer because the employer cannot understand the different types of Girl Scout cookies out there. So this industry is in need of a serious cleanup. But separate from whatever the government does, individual businesses can make better decisions and put these money games out of business.
Yeah, can you give some practical tips on how businesses can do that, and also for individual healthcare consumers?
Sure. Well, I tell individuals to use the app GoodRx or the website GoodRx.com. There's some others out there. And don't offer your insurance information before you pick up your medication. You'd be amazed how the price without insurance can be less sometimes because the PBMs create these artificial copays that sometimes steer patients to more expensive medications for the employer paying the cost of it.
So you're saying it might be cheaper to pay for your prescriptions without using your insurance card? Is that
exactly
because of these money games?
And that's what these apps will tell you. By the way, you can do the same with medical services, looking at the what we call the market price on websites like Healthcare Blue Book and fairhealth.org. And you can actually see what the going price is for a medical service. But with pharmacy plans, most businesses can renegotiate their contract with a pharmacy plan. So most businesses, when they want to provide healthcare for their employees, they buy two products. They buy health insurance off the shelf, and they also buy a pharmacy plan. Well, they don't really understand the pharmacy plans. The health insurance companies say, hey, this is our preferred pharmacy plan, so just use our preferred company. And there's gouging on the pharmacy plans that employers cannot understand. There's a whole new network now of consultants and agents that are coming in and they're saying, look, we're not going to take kickbacks on the back end like most agents and brokers do that advise businesses on healthcare. We're going to be your independent fiduciary and we're going to renegotiate that contract for you. And some of those individuals I've listed on restoringmedicine.org and get into their stories in the book. And typically they walk in and save a business $250,000 or $500,000 overnight by cutting through these money games on their employers' contracts with pharmacy plans.
Yeah, I mean, these are great tips for people going forward. Do you have any tips for people who are facing down a huge medical bill right now? If they're one of the 1 in 5 Americans who has medical debt and collections, which is pretty astounding.
Oh, yeah, it's so hard to listen to these stats, you know, even as you say it now. It's a disgrace to our profession. I'm proud to be a doctor. But I mean, half of women with stage 4 breast cancer now have medical debt in collections and have been contacted and harassed by debt collectors. This is a disgrace. We need to restore public accountability to hospitals. And that means when you get a bill that is unfair, you deserve and should demand an ability to appeal certain things on there. 80% of bills from hospitals have errors on the itemized bill. And if you're not getting through to the call center person, go to the CFO, have the hospital operator transfer you to the executive suite. Talk to your doctor. You know, a lot of patients don't want to bother us doctors with their bills. Engage the doctors. We want to help. We want to be your internal advocate within the hospital. And if you're getting nowhere with anyone, go to the hospital board. The board members are supposed to be liaisons to the community. They are the public accountability of a local hospital's leadership, and they should be engaged. Oftentimes, the rare times they find out about something, they get involved. And otherwise, it's just kind of a problem of people who cannot afford care. Half of America has less than $400 of cash in savings. We got to remember those people in healthcare when we're delivering care.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dr. Marty McCary. He's a surgeon and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the author of a new book called The Price We Pay. So, Marty, you're talking about medical bills. How can a person know if the bill they've received is unfair? You said there's a way they can check prices?
Well, you know, hospitals should have a duty to explain services before they offer them. That is elective, non-urgent stuff. I basically believe that if a hospital will not show you a price on request, they have no right to shake you down and ruin your credit history and take you to court and garnish your paycheck. Now, patients should ask for prices. When they get bills, they should Google the codes, the medical codes Find out what the service was and figure out if, in fact, you had that service. Many times there's mistakes on the bill, and the best ways to get your bills negotiated with discounts is to point out that you never had certain services done, that the options were never explained, that you asked for a price and were given a runaround, and also to just explain the financial hardship situation you may be in. And I've talked to a lot of hospital leaders that say if somebody explains financial hardship, they will knock 5 or 20% right off the top and sometimes offer a payment plan. But before you do a payment plan, make sure that you're not paying more than the going reference-based price. Google those services on the internet. Look them up on Healthcare Blue Book and fairhealth.org and make sure you're getting a fair price before you get put into some long payment plan.
You know, I wonder, for people listening and hearing about the business of healthcare, how it's bankrupting people, you know, some people might hear this and think the whole system just can't be trusted. Doctors can't be trusted. What would you say to them, or say to someone who feels like, you know, hearing this, like, I need to just stay away from doctors altogether?
Well, we don't want to create hysteria. Most doctors do the right thing and always try to. They're also very honest about our overtreatment problem. 20% of all medical care is unnecessary, according to a national survey we conducted of doctors. Look, good quality medicine is something all of us doctors aspire to. Most doctors are doing that. But people need to be aware of what's out there. Now, when I show these egregious bills of price gouging to doctors, saying, hey, do you know your patient was sued in court over this bill for your service? They are outraged. They're livid. They want to fight for their patient, and they want to do the right thing. So don't be afraid to bother us doctors with your bills and point out some of the issues with bills. Doctors need to get more engaged, and every time we do engage them, they are fierce fighters for patients.
Your book highlights some of the disruptors of this system, and you mentioned this earlier in our conversation. So we have just a few minutes left, and I just want to make sure we save time to discuss, where are examples of clinics doing it differently or of people doing it better?
Well, there's a great network of clinics that's sprouting up all over the country called relationship-based clinics. They go by the names of Oak Street, which is based largely in Illinois, Iora, Landmark, ChenMed, and they're saying, look, billing is for the birds. We doctors are sick of billing. Let's get rid of billing and let's just take care of patients. We'll get paid in a lump sum format, either from a business, an employer, or if you're a Medicare beneficiary, you don't have to pay a penny. Medicare will agree to use this new relationship-based clinic in lieu of your other clinic. And doctors in those clinics are doing amazing things. They're talking about food as medicine. They're treating gut problems with, you know, recommending different things you should eat and cook. They're treating diabetes with cooking classes in their clinics. They are treating back pain with ice and physical therapy instead of surgery and opioids routinely. And we're seeing this movement now to try to address the root causes of chronic illness. They're even treating what I think is one of the greatest public health problems today no one's talking about, the problem of loneliness. And loneliness among seniors is a big problem. They are creating communities. And so we're seeing a group of doctors rise up in these new clinics and say, let us practice medicine the way it was meant to be practiced. And these money games are threatening the practice of medicine.
Do you feel that approach is scalable? Is that something that we could see have more widespread adoption?
Yes, we're seeing it right now. These clinics, which generally started in the time period of 2011, 2013, have now sprouted up. Each of those five companies I mentioned to you, or practices, have over 50 clinics around the country. So they're growing like wildfire. Look, people are hungry for this kind of relationship-based medicine, spending time with their doc, having a navigator assigned to them to help them coordinate this messy and fragmented healthcare system. So patients are sick of our broken primary care system. Doctors are sick of our broken primary care system. This is a way to redesign care from scratch, and it's exciting.
Marty, we just have a few minutes left, so I don't want to ask specifically about politics because your book doesn't necessarily get into a political debate about these things. But I did want to know what your opinion is with all of the chatter related to healthcare, especially now leading up to the 2020 elections. What do you feel like is missing from the conversation that's not being discussed but really should be discussed? And I guess, what are your ideas for where policymakers should be focusing their efforts in terms of policy changes that would actually lead to real solutions for people?
Well, the politicians are talking about different ways to finance our broken healthcare system. We need to talk about how to fix our broken healthcare system, not just how to pay for it differently. If we keep throwing good money after bad into this broken system, it's going to erode into every other national priority. You know, if we can turn off the cable news echo chambers and talk about where there's consensus, I believe there's broad consensus around healthcare in the United States, believe it or not. You know, a pothole is not a red or blue issue. Corruption is not a Republican or Democrat issue. And I think there's broad consensus to restore medicine back to its mission, to remember that most hospitals were built to be a safe haven to care for anybody, that we can practice relationship-based medicine and encourage that, as we're seeing now through Medicare. And if we look at the amount of money we spend on healthcare as a country, we already spend enough money to give everyone who lives in our borders gold-plated healthcare. We just have to cut the waste. And I think there's broad consensus if we can focus in on the common sense solutions. And that's why I wrote this book, to create healthcare literacy where we can appeal to the best in people. And in the same way The Big Short created literacy around the finance industry, I wanted to create literacy so we can come together and really adopt common sense solutions with or without the government.
And that book is called The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. Dr. Marty McCary is the author of that book. Marty, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Great to be with you, Christine.
That's all the time we have for today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montecilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Christine Herman. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.